You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this fine podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for August 30th, 2013. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside the George W. Bush Grand Public Square in beautiful downtown Baghdad, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
Hey, everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. You want to explain why we are in the just outside the George W. Bush
Grand Public Square
in beautiful downtown Baghdad?
Yeah.
It's for the weather, right?
It's for the weather.
It's cooler there than it is in southern Illinois right now.
It's cooler near the lake. That's right. It's because we are approaching another anniversary.
Not just the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington.
No, that was a vital and important one. And I'm very glad it was done up right. Mm-hmm. Not the 10th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, which some people actually noticed. David Brooks took pains to write 1.2 paragraphs or smuggle 1.2 paragraphs onto the NewsHour saying, I think what we've learned is something to do with humility. Fuck you, David Brooks.
I hate to open our discussion of Syria with this, but
well here's
what does David Brooks think about Syria? I can't believe I just said that.
David Brooks is on vacation right now.
How convenient, just like Congress.
Just some of the happiest words you can ever read in the New York Times. But the reason I bring it up is the 10th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq was addressed by the media in the most glancing way. They had to acknowledge it, but all the people who got it wrong and who put people on their show, who packed their show with neoconservatives and Republicans and conservatives, made mention of it and then moved on to the next thing.
Yeah.
No, the anniversary that's coming up now is the anniversary of the war to pretend that the war in Iraq was going great.
Oh.
And that started almost immediately after the invasion. After we dismissed the Iraqi army, after this thing called the insurgency that we were promised would never happen happened, after people dressed as Iraqi soldiers started showing up and killing Americans, after IEDs started blowing people up, after it all started to fall apart and the people who had been planning for an invasion of Iraq as a contingency for years at the State Department started showing up on camera going, we kind of told them all this was going to happen. We were told to fuck off. And that was when the entire right-wing media, most of the mainstream media, almost all of the blogging right-wing media, Town Hall, Red State, Michelle Malkin, Ann Coulter, Bill Kristol, the whole batshit lot of them, doubled down on how dare you question this president? How dare you disloyal, filthy liberal bastards ever hint that anything is ever going to go wrong in Iraq because it's all going just goddamn fine. And it was 10 years ago.
Which is why we need to trust the authority of the media again, right?
Yes. I don't trust the authority of the media, but I also don't pretend that George Bush 1 is George Bush 2.
Mm-hmm.
And neither of them are Eisenhower. And Eisenhower isn't Truman. And Truman isn't Obama.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry that we got really, really horribly burned by the people that lied to us during the previous administration. And maybe that's happening now. And maybe it's not. But the default position that, well, everything the government says is a lie. And everyone in the government, this administration, are being run by the same neoconservative cabal that got us into the last war is just not true.
Well, and that goes back to the analogy that I was making the other day about the economy with one of our correspondents. One of our listeners is either active duty military or recently retired military. And he wrote me and said, look, I hate to say this, but just send the cruise missiles already because I really don't want to see another country firsthand. I've just had it. And he's been to Iraq and been to Afghanistan, and he doesn't want to go.
Yeah.
And he wrote more about that than that was just sort of flippant. But he was serious about, I don't want to go to war anymore. I'm done.
No.
And I totally understand that.
There's a everyone's sick of it.
Yeah.
And
but the part that I wrote to him about was, you know, we've talked a lot about how Barack Obama has been required to clean up the mess of the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. But the Bush administration also left the trust of the American public in the war machine that is the federal government
in tatters. Yeah.
And perhaps that trust is not worthy of being revisited. You know, maybe we do need to be continually, maybe that's a good thing, that we should just be continually very suspicious of any move towards war. That might be a very healthy thing.
I think that's an incredibly healthy position. I think and this is where I don't want to see a single piece of American hardware or software or human put into Syria at all. Unless there's an overwhelmingly compelling case that the good of the globe and the good of my country are in the balance, and that nothing short of doing that will solve that.
Well, what do you think about, I mean, my initial reaction to hearing about what is apparently, and there's the magic word, apparently, chemical weapons attack. What happens when we know that a regime has used chemical weapons? What do we do?
Well, that's an excellent question.
Because my initial reaction is they need to have the shit bombed out of them.
Yeah, that's right.
And removed from power by whatever means we have.
And then what?
Yeah. Exactly. Is that expense always going to fall in our lap as the United States? And I, you know, I'm only half serious about this, but I really wish Obama would just say to Congress, "We're broke."
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, if we can't afford food stamps, if we can't afford Meals on Wheels, if we can't afford Head Start, we certainly can't afford to do anything in Syria. Sorry.
Well,
you know, the sequestered military that we have isn't just up to the task. Sorry about that. And, you know, we have this debt ceiling coming up. So
we got no money.
I'm going to hold it hostage, and I'm going to hold your war plans hostage, John McCain, until we have a debt ceiling.
Yeah. And maybe then after that, we'll need a tax increase to make up.
Yeah, and a tax increase, because we're going to pay for this up front, you know, just like we pay for our hurricanes.
Yeah.
And our tornadoes. You know, we got to find the money somewhere else. You're going to have to find it out of some other military.
Remember, pay as you go. This is pay as you bomb.
Pay as you bomb with taxes, not with cuts. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, and this is how screwed up our public debate has become. We really can't even start to have a debate, because right out of the box,
Congress is dysfunctional.
Well, Congress is dysfunctional. Nobody trusts the media. And both for very good reasons, and the immediate reflex from some of the people on my side of the aisle. Mm-hmm. When you hear there's a chemical weapons attack by a very bad guy, it wouldn't shock me horribly that a bad guy did a bad thing after killing his own people for 10 years. The immediate reaction is, well, since this is obviously not true, What are the real motives of the Obama administration for lying us into war?
Right, right.
And
right.
It's like, well, okay,
it doesn't matter.
Can we fucking have a timeout on the government? There is a real difference. I know it doesn't seem that way to some people who wear special glasses, but there's an actual real difference between being skeptical of what government says and what the media say, and automatically believing that everything everyone tells you who isn't in your bubble is lying to you for nefarious reasons that you will never learn, because that's what Fox News viewers are. Mm-hmm. That's their world. And it disturbs me immensely that so many of the people on my side of the aisle seem very comfortable with that stance, that it isn't sufficient that you prove to me, because remember, Colin Powell proved, and that was a lie, wasn't it? Therefore, everything everyone says is always a lie, and therefore there's never going to be a
reason. And where's the motivation for lying? We have to find that.
Yeah. That's what we have to go in search
for. And there is a big difference, as I've said on an earlier podcast, between using falsely drummed up false intelligence to create a war that you've been wishing for since the Ford administration.
Yep. Yep.
In order to make money for Halliburton.
And that's why you got into government. That's why you set up your little think tank.
The difference between using quote-unquote intelligence to do that and using intelligence to get Osama bin Laden, to find out for sure whether chemical weapons were used or not in Syria.
Yeah. And now,
those are things that we should be spying to find out.
Yes. Well, and if I really wanted to be the person to make this call, I would run for office and become president eventually, and then that would be my job. But right now, I don't see any harm in waiting for Congress to come back.
No.
I see no harm in saying, you know what? As candidate Obama, I said we should always have congressional oversight and congressional approval of this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I think Congress should be, whether they want to or not, and they clearly don't want to be, dragged into this. Mm-hmm. Look, you guys
dragged
have the power
back
to...
from their August recess because this is an international emergency.
I need the Congress to meet in emergency session to decide, A, if you believe the evidence that we have accumulated is valid enough to make a decision. And I'm going to give you all the evidence. I'm going to tell you everything we've got. You can kick the tires. You can interview the people. I'm not going to hide some lunatic named Curveball away from you.
Yes,
and ask you to take my word for it. You get to interview. You get to talk to everybody involved. And then once you've reached a sober decision worthy of the world's greatest deliberative body, then we're going to have another debate over what to do about it. And the answer might well be nothing, mm-hmm. because we're going to sit this one out. We're going to say, you know what? The United Nations is there for a reason. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to take our case to the United Nations. We're going to do this the way that we're supposed to do it and just see what happens. Who knows? It might work. It might be in a horrible embarrassment. It might be a mistake. But all of that could be done without sacrificing one iota of our national security or our good name, which we don't have anymore because of all the fucking mistakes we made in the past.
So what we're going to do, Drew Glass, is just I'm going to paste in our conversation we had yesterday with Bob Seska with a very light edit because three ways are hard to edit, people.
They really are. Everybody feels bad afterwards or they're great. There's just no middle ground, really. And I think we have the best sound editor in the business.
Oh,
Frank.
Thank you. Well, we'll work it out. But it was a wonderful conversation. And those of you who don't want to hear about Glenn Greenwald will be happy to know that we actually talk about other things. I steer the conversation toward finding solutions to the NSA problem. So here it is.
Hi, it's Bob.
Hi, Bob.
Oh, hello, Bob.
I'm waiting for Chez.
Oh, is Chez? I didn't even know Chez was joining us until I got your email.
Oh, okay. Well, he's invited. So that's up to you and up to him. And we can talk. And if he comes online, fine.
Oh, okay.
But we don't want him to feel left out.
We don't want him to be left out. He's welcome to come on and be a pervert on our show, too. So he's dirtbag. I think he said dirtbag yesterday.
And he can swear up a storm if he wants to.
Yeah. On our show, he can swear all he wants. So.
I don't know if you guys caught the show. Like, actually, I mean, he did. He had me fucking doubled over.
he did us too.
Yeah. Really,
he was doing that Steve Lonergan voice.
Right.
Jesus, that was hilarious.
Very funny. Very funny. We have not listened to the after party yet, but we have referred to it on this week's podcast because Drew Glass was very interested in your reflections on the newsroom, and he's decided that Babylon 5 is just like the newsroom in so many ways.
Really? I've never heard that. Babylon 5,
In that the first season was terrible.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah.
Is that the only thing they have in
common? Pretty much the only similarity, yeah. It took them several episodes to shake off that adolescent woodenness and the really bad stuff that was drawn into the characters that was sort of trial ballooned. Mm-hmm. And they finally figured out, oh, yeah, we got to get rid of all this junk and start telling the story we want to tell. And then it got good. But yeah.
Yeah. I'm more of a Star Trek guy. I never watched Babylon 5.
Oh,
no, me neither. Me neither.
He says incredulously. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Did you ever see the new Battlestar Galactica?
I started watching it on Netflix not too long ago. I didn't watch it when it was on. Yeah. But I started reviewing it because it's on Netflix. And so I love it. I think it's great.
Yeah, it's really I'm amazed someone could take a series that bad and mm-hmm. turn it into something that was actually watchable and good and relevant and politically dangerous and fascinating to watch. Yeah.
Too many people were thrown in the airlock, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
When you've got a limited amount of human beings left in the universe to just decide to randomly throw them in the airlock because you just don't like them is, I don't know.
That's why you're never going to make Admiral, honey.
I know. I'm never going to make Admiral. You're right.
Hey, did you see the new Washington Post Snowden things today?
No.
But he's a genius and
he's a genius, I tell you.
He did far more damage than anyone had ever suspected that stuff.
Well, there's a new Gelman article. Bart Gelman.
No, I didn't see that.
Published a new thing. It's a Snowden document. Well, they actually have two Snowden documents that they published about today. One was about the intelligence community's black budget, which is their secret budget for the entire intelligence, CIA, NSA, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so there was that. That was Gelman's piece. And then there was a sister piece from a Snowden document about the killing of bin Laden.
Hmm.
Because this is all about civil liberties, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
This, what they're doing, what they did was, this has nothing, first of all, it has nothing to do with eavesdropping. It has everything to do with just, this is just like radical transparency. This is not whistleblowing. It's not, not revealing wrongdoing. They're just saying, well, here's how the intelligence community spends its money. And here's, you know, the systems that we used in order to get bin Laden.
Yeah. This is Ben Kingsley in sneakers.
Yeah. No secrets. Right.
You know, just dump it out. Everything goes out there. And
yeah.
I'm delighted to know that, you know, we have a black budget. It's all very interesting. But the predicate for your entire thing was we need to have a conversation about the NSA surveillance and the FISA court. And about 80% of everything that I've read so far from that source or from those sources has nothing to do at all with anything like that. And that's just,
Now, where did the Washington Post get these documents?
Edward Snowden.
He gave them to the Post.
Yes. Yes.
So these are all. They didn't come off of Mr. Miranda's Game Boy One or anything like that.
No.
Okay.
They came
confiscated from Game Boy One, right?
No, they came from Edward Snowden. And in fact, the black budget documents had a series of things in there that the Washington Post didn't even publish because they were consulting with, Gelman was consulting with unnamed government officials who were saying, you can't publish this because it's going to do some serious damage.
Right,
but
right.
There was no instruction like that.
You mean there was like responsible journalism engaged in this?
Yeah, and people are actually attacking Gelman.
Yeah, for not publishing everything.
Yeah, for not publishing everything. And you know, I asked him on Twitter. I said, "Did Edward Snowden give you any instructions about how to handle this document?" Mm-hmm. And he said, "No." So this whole thing that Snowden didn't want any damaging information going into the press is kind of not holding water.
Well, and what about his promise to the Russian government that he would discontinue his shenanigans? Is he violating that promise to Putin?
Well, yes and no, because he had given Gelman and Greenwald and everyone else copies of these documents in the beginning, long before Russia was in the picture or so.
Okay. All right. But he's apparently, is he giving up on Greenwald or is he just?
No, I think the point is that the documents are in the wind now.
Okay.
There are at least three or four different sources, possibly if the, I can't think of the name, Independent, who just published the Listening Post, the British Listening Post that they say came from a stash of Snowden documents.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. That means if it's at least the case that four or five or six different outfits, and certainly at least that many friends of his around the internet who are, you know, stashed away in case something happens to him, have copies of this stuff. Mm. At least parts of copies of it. And
if you remember, both Gelman and Greenwald wrote about PRISM. They both had the PRISM documents. So I think Greenwald has all of these same documents. And I shudder to think what Greenwald would have done with the black budget.
Yeah.
If he could have published everything. Certainly, I can't even imagine that Greenwald would have consulted with U.S. government officials. I don't know.
Yeah. I want to first of all, welcome Bob Seska to the Professional Laugh. We're kind of in medias res here.
Well, nothing like diving right in.
We enjoyed being on your show this week. And
very much.
Glad to have you on ours, too.
Yeah, it's sort of, this is like Letterman going on The Tonight Show and then Johnny going on Letterman.
We wanted to talk to you a little bit about some of the criticisms that you specifically have received from John Cole, who I really like John Cole, so I'm a little upset that Daddy and Daddy are fighting. But Bob, you've been accused, Bob, of avoiding finding solutions to the NSA mess by dwelling on Glenn Greenwald. I think that's a fair assessment of some of the criticism you've received.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you to respond to that. And specifically, I heard you say on a couple of podcasts ago, you actually had some, I thought, really clear ideas on how to fix the NSA mess.
Yeah.
And including stuff about the FISA court. So I'd like you to talk about leaving Greenwald out of it just for a little bit, how and assuming a functional Congress, which is hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah.
What can we advocate for?
Okay.
To fix the FISA, NSA, transparency, privacy issue as it's laid out right now.
To the reasonable man standard. This is
right.
This is what a reasonable citizen of democracy should expect from.
Should be able to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, there are several things. I wanted to clarify, though. When I was talking about The Tonight Show and Letterman, I was talking about the old days, not The Tonight Show.
Yeah.
Johnny.
Now, let me be clear that we're not.
That's why I'm still Angie Dickinson today. Yes.
Yeah. I was thinking about that metaphor in my head, and I'm going, no, that's going to come out wrong. And no, I wanted to clarify. That was the old days when Letterman and Johnny Carson were on the same network and they were friends. So anyway, as far as reforms go, I think the first place you got to start is at the FISA court, which is a mess. I mean, some of the most alarming news that I've seen coming out of all of this is the fact that the Chief Justice is the sole arbiter of who sits on that court. So right now, John Roberts and before him, William Rehnquist, were choosing all of the judges sitting on the FISA court. Consequently, all but one of the judges are Republicans. There is only one Democratic judge on that panel. And, you know, well, they're supposed to be impartial. They're judges.
Well, that explains why Daryl Issa doesn't want to investigate them.
Sure.
I was wondering about that. Like, Daryl Issa could and the Republican House could really cook Barack Obama's bacon by investigating the NSA and the FISA courts and how Barack Obama interacts with those and really decide to take the reins of national security as the Constitution allows them to do and repeal the Patriot Act instead of Obamacare and decide that they're going to oversee, as the House Oversight Committee is supposed to do, the executive branch's administration of national security issues.
And by the way, we don't think this is funny.
No.
The laughter
just
you're hearing.
Just funny to think about the Congress actually doing that.
The laughter you're hearing in the background is a 10-year-old.
Oh, yeah. And I need to tell her to quiet down a little bit.
It's like talking to Chez. Chez has his daughter.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess, am I allowed? Is obscenity allowed on this show?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yesterday when we were doing the after party, we were talking about Miley Cyrus. And so I asked Chez what twerking was. I honestly didn't know what twerking was. And he says, oh, that's when you shake your ass. And in the background, you hear 5-year-old Inara go, shake your ass? You're not supposed to say that. Don't talk like that. That's bad. Bad language. But anyway, I think that's another place, but a less practical route to take would be to ultimately repeal the Patriot Act, turn over the roll back the authorization for use of military force from 2001 that basically authorized the entire war on terror, which would then, you know, regulate the use of drones, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But the practicality of that is very the possibility of that actually happening is very slim.
With this Congress, and that to me is the reason why Glenn Greenwald is able to suck up so much oxygen in the conversation is because we have such a completely dysfunctional Congress. No one wants to waste their time talking about what actually ought to happen.
Yeah, sure.
So
you know, it's still a difficult thing to achieve, but I do think that you could very reasonably reform the way that, I mean, there is legislation in the works right now to change the way the FISA court functions.
Mm-hmm. And
what we have seen, I think the big misunderstanding here is that NSA is this huge rogue operation that has no oversight, no internal oversight, no bureaucracy, just it's a bunch of analysts reading all of your emails.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I don't think that's the case at all. And I think that's the source of all of this, you know, everything I've been talking about since the story broke and trying to suggest to people that it's a thing that is scary on the surface, but it's not as scary as you might think it is.
Mm-hmm.
It deals with a lot of scary things, and there's a lot of potential for scary things to occur in there. But as far as we're seeing, it's not really a systemic issue with the NSA doing all of these scary things. It just looks really scary from the outside peering in. And it's like any other government bureaucracy. You're going to have so many different layers. I mean, and it's very it's It's so difficult. My dad was a lifelong government worker. I mean, he started at, believe it or not, the IRS as an internal auditor, and then ended up retiring as the Inspector General of the Treasury, which was a pretty big deal. But I mean, what I learned through him is kind of how a bureaucracy functions, and how, you know, they use jargon, and there's just so many layers of oversight and duplication and making sure that everything is going in a way that they're not going to be called up on the Hill and grilled by members of Congress, because no one wants that. It's just, it's so huge and massive, and there's so many people looking over everyone else's shoulders that, you know, there's absolutely oversight in place. But I think making that oversight more efficient and having a little bit more transparency at the FISA court level, I think is a big step in the right direction.
There's a conversation to be had, what I call over in the better universe. Mm-hmm. There's a definitely a conversation, a long public conversation to be had about things like that. I have a lot of experience up close and personal with the government myself, mm-hmm. on a more local level. And I saw exactly how I worked in the private sector, insurance companies. I've worked in the education sector. I've worked for colleges, and I've seen all kinds of bureaucracies, public, private, and educational up close. And they're all the same in that they're so dedicated to not making any mistakes in the sense of screwing up bureaucratically that the amount of secrecy and inertia and double checking and triple checking and, oh my God, I don't want to learn about my department by opening up the Sun Times and seeing what so-and-so said about it, that almost nothing gets done. I mean, they're frozen in place, which really is sort of the perfect Republican government.
Yeah.
Because you're so afraid of being kicked in the balls for doing anything that you stay well within inside the box. The other conversation I think is worth having is, what's the failure rate you think is acceptable mm-hmm. for any human institution, any large bureaucratic human institution that will make mistakes? I want a much lower failure rate for, say, I don't know, the police, who can pull out a gun and shoot me, than from a caseworker somewhere. But there's a certain amount of screw-ups that are going to happen in any human institution. And if you simply pick them out and say these aren't – it's not that these are bad and the system requires reform, but that any failure at all is sufficient to declare the entire system corrupt and bankrupt and shut it all down. That's simply not a legitimate conversation to have, because it's simply not realistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's what's going on right now. You have an organization like the NSA and we confirmed this today with the release of this black budget, mm-hmm. which every time I hear black budget, I think red wedding. It's, I don't know why. But so, I mean, what we learned is that there are around 40,000 NSA employees. Mm-hmm. And that should put into perspective the fact that there has only been one serious idiot per year for the last 10 years who has deliberately abused the system, either to eavesdrop on his ex-wife or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty good success rate. If you have an organization with 40,000 employees mm-hmm. and only one of them deliberately violates the rules, that's a great track record, and they're doing something right. And I think that speaks to the power of the bureaucracy and the power of the oversight of, you know, whether it's the Oversight and Compliance Director or whether it's the Office of Inspector General. There are people keeping an eye internally. And that's what, when we're learning about all of these mistakes. Mm-hmm. Well, I say all of them with tongue in cheek, through the NSA itself.
Right. They are hiring the same kind of person over and over again, like astronauts do, where you have done enough of a background check on these people to know whether they're going to behave themselves in a certain way within that bureaucracy. And they're doing a good job of screening. I don't want to have dinner with people like that. Yeah. I don't think they're going to be terribly interesting. But you want those kind of people working and guarding your secrets, so to speak. Yeah.
And we don't want those jobs privatized.
No.
Frankly.
No. Right.
We don't want those jobs outsourced.
Outsourced, yeah.
But this comes from the fetish we used to have, we still have, with the private sector doing everything better. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That you can outsource everything. The city of Chicago has pretty much run itself up on rails doing this over and over again and finding out much too late that, no, you really do want to retain control of public utilities, mm-hmm. public amenities, public parks, public software, the sort of the infrastructure that makes the whole thing go. The minute you privatize that to a point where every couple of years you have to renegotiate a contract with somebody who doesn't necessarily have your best interests at heart,
right,
you end up their hostage.
Mm-hmm.
And they end up being able to take that expertise anywhere they want to go, because guess what? It's a free market. They can go anywhere they wish. And I would recommend to anybody Rachel Maddow's book, Drift.
Yeah, yeah.
Just an overview of the splitting off of executive authority from proper oversight.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wish that's the conversation we could have.
Mm-hmm.
It, because we have to begin, at least in my opinion, by asking the question, are we going to have to spy on people? Is that a necessary function? And, you know, Sun Tzu was writing about spying 2,500 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's not like it's a new thing. It's not like governments can just pretend that that's no longer necessary and that they can just dump it. So once you establish the fact that, you know what you're going to have? You're going to have people who spy on other people and other countries to keep your country from getting screwed economically, physically, what have you. Then you have the conversation about how best to do that. But you can't have that conversation with people who think, no, 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 there is no amount of surveillance that is acceptable. The amount of acceptable surveillance from the public sector is zero.
Yeah.
And that's simply not realistic. And you can't have a conversation with people who have a completely unrealistic expectation about what governments should and should not do.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if Edward Snowden would have happened if he had been government employee working at Fort Meade.
Yeah.
I doubt it. And this is, I mean, I think Booz Allen Hamilton is as much to blame in this whole huge saga as Ed Snowden.
Mm-hmm. Clearly,
their oversight within Booz Allen Hamilton to prevent leaks and so forth, which can be good, and they can also be very, very damaging. It just failed. I mean, they failed to prevent this. And I think one of the reforms that could occur is to roll back all of this, as you said, all of this outsourcing that's going on. And there's mm-hmm. there's mm-hmm. so much waste when it comes to government contractors, especially at DOD, where I learned, I mean, I spoke to a contractor a couple of years ago who told me that the way the system works is that you could produce nothing over the course of a year and get at least a 5% increase in your budget
mm-hmm.
as a contractor.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And that's mm-hmm. and that's mm-hmm. terrible. You can just sit on your hands mm-hmm. and for the next year, you can get a bump in terms of how much government mm-hmm. money you're receiving. That's heinously wrong.
Well, I must say, Bob, you're
And they own the media as well. I mean, I always say when everyone talks about David Gregory, how are your war stocks doing? You know, a lot of these guys own stock in I want transparency in where David Brooks invests his money. I want to know all the natural gas companies he owns.
Yeah.
I want to know all the defense contractors that he's invested in and how he is then influencing public discussion in order to line his own pockets and the pockets of his rich friends. And you know that's happening.
Yeah, I mean, for the last 30 years, years, I've been watching the McLaughlin Group with ads for Boeing mm-hmm. for Boeing in that show. And there's no reason whatsoever that there should be commercials on a Sunday show. And that's, that's a little more disconnected than actually their investment portfolio. But it's
But it's still there. They're sponsoring Archer Daniels Midland and corporate farming and defense contractors.
This whole thing where I connected an episode of Meet the Press with the clean coal industry. It was remarkable how incestuous it all is.
Uh-huh,
where you had guests on Meet the Press who were directly related to the clean coal industry talking about energy mm-hmm. policy, and then having clean coal political action groups advertising on that show, on that exact episode.
Yep. And then they show clips from the show at their websites. That's what happens with David Brooks. ExxonMobil will say, even David Brooks supports blah, 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 ExxonMobil, mm-hmm. And clean energy in this regard or fracking.
Yeah, that was
kind
of hilarious when in the middle of some conversation on Meet the Gregory, he says, by the way, you know what's really cool? Natural gas drilling. That's just awesome. It's a bright future for America. A lot of jobs there. I just can't think of anything better than getting that natural gas out of the ground.
And getting that natural gas through fracking. It's just an amazing technology we can all be proud of. Yeah.
Literally out of nowhere. And then the next day, it's on their website. Even David Brooks.
Yep, it's on their website.
Respected, you know.
Approves of. Yeah. Yeah. So I want to ask you one last question,
guys. I just
want
to point out that so far, Bob Seska, our guest from the Bubble Genius Bob and Chez show, has been a really terrible jackbooted servant of imperial power.
I know. And he will not read the facts from the White House. I don't understand.
Keep failing to blindly defend the Department of Defense, blindly defend FISA, blindly defend oversight. And the other things.
And you're coming up with actual solutions, which we hate, because we don't think liberals should ever agree to agree. That doesn't sound intelligent.
So shame on you, Bob Seska, for failing in your duty to the White House.
But I guess that's my last question to both of you, because you are both experts in anti-Greenwaldism.
Well, I'm pro-journalist. That's all. I'm pro-good journalism.
Yeah. No, I think that's it. That's it. Good journalism. But I have seen in your comment threads a vocal group, and what I want to ask you is, do you think they're the majority or the minority of people that do not want to agree with this White House under any circumstances? Is that a straw man, or is that the majority just in your comment thread? And how, I mean, you have mentioned to me, Bob, that you think Glenn Greenwald is incredibly influential.
Yeah, I think he is.
And I want to kind of talk about how much power does that side of the left have?
I think it's still that side of the left is still the fringe. And I think it's small, or I would say smaller than where I would consider myself to be, which is sort of center left, but pragmatic center left. But I still believe that Greenwald is sort of the Pied Piper of that entire group. And on this story itself, his influence is much broader. He is influencing other journalists in terms of style, in terms of content. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, has been remarkably dangerous, because this kind of misleading journalism that's happening with Greenwald is now seeping into other publications. You see it at Mother Jones, and you see, I mean, Mother Jones, for God's sake, I have so much respect for Mother Jones, but they published a great article. It was otherwise, I mean, the content of it was really interesting, but the headline was "How to Keep the NSA Out of Your Computer."
I
couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe I was reading this headline implying that the NSA is somehow in your computer. And then there's this app that you can install onto your browser called Ghostery that tells you what cookies and corporate trackers are on each website that you visit. And I ran a Ghostery search on that page, on that Mother Jones article about how the NSA is in your computer. There were 26 corporate trackers on that page.
Yeah.
And literally downloading cookies onto my computer. So the NSA isn't in my computer. Mother Jones was in my computer. You know, in terms of what's a majority and minority on this side? I don't really know for sure, but I would say definitely that there are far more reasonable people than there are idiots who want to undo the two-party system. And I just think people have better things to worry about. They want to know where their next paycheck is coming from. They want to know whether they're going to be able to get a job or pay for college. They're not concerned as to whether or not the NSA has their metadata.
And you know, the really good news, Bob, is that thanks to Miley Cyrus, they aren't concerned about Sydney Leathers anymore.
Yeah, thank God. You know,
I have no idea who that even is. Oh, yeah, Sydney Leathers
is Anthony Weiner's texting partner.
Exactly,
And how quickly we forget.
Thank God.
So right now, I'm very influenced by Will McAvoy, who doesn't pay attention. Yeah.
Well, Bob, we appreciate having you on the show so much, and this exchange of talent, on-air talent, has been fantastic for us.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you so much.
We enjoyed it.
Bob Seska, I said it during the tape conversation, Bob Seska is a terribly incompetent tool of imperial power at the White House.
Well, I'm going to go to Hawaii and take away his Obama bot card.
Yeah.
So that was a great conversation with Bob Seska. We hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget to check out Bob Seska's podcast with Chez Pazienza at the Bubble Genius Bob and Chez show. That is on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and all the other usual places. Each week, we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitty is Jax, who likes to snuggle with a furry moose doll. And as in the case of all internet kitties, we don't judge.
No.
Do we?
No.
You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service Go Postal Union's letter on the air unless you say otherwise. And I do want to shout out a special thank you. We got two packages in the post office box this week.
We did.
One had some very interesting books on tape, including a Hitchhiker's Guide on version on books on tape.
Thank you.
And the other was a box from a Peace Corps.
Volunteer.
Peace
public
Corps.
Servant, if
public
you will.
Public servant.
Mm-hmm.
Who sent us, what was the bill? It was Guyana money.
Money from Guyana. Just a very colorful piece of currency from Guyana,
yeah.
Which will impress the hell out
wasn't
of
Wasn't it $1,000 or something? It was $1,000 bill, which he said is worth 50 cents.
Yeah, something like that.
$100 bill worth 50 cents. So the kids love looking at currency from around the world. So we appreciate that. And then he sent us a very beautiful handmade hairpin from there as well.
Made from locally available
materials. And yeah, just a very nice little artifact. Yeah. So thank you so much for both of those boxes. We appreciate your very kind gifts.
So, Blue Gal.
Yes, Driftglass.
How are the internet kitties doing this Labor Day weekend?
The internet kitties are sad that Miley Cyrus has ruined Foam Fingers for everyone.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey dovin. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2013, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
I just pasted these questions in because they're very general questions. I apologize. I don't have the names of the people who sent them in with me. That was dumb. But thank you to the listeners who sent these questions in.
Damn you, Barack Obama. These are all from the White House.
First question asked is, I have just finished reading Lawrence Wright's book, Going Clear, which is a history of Scientology.
Yeah.
My question is, how is it possible that someone as smart as Robert Heinlein could have been taken in by Ron Hubbard, an obvious liar and sociopath? I know there were others like Jack Williamson, L. Sprague DeCamp, etc.
Right.
But I'm particularly interested in Driftglass's analysis of Heinlein's involvement.
Sure. That is a very good question. You just have the timeline backwards.
Oh.
Robert Heinlein was not a Scientologist. Robert Heinlein was probably an agnostic. I don't know. He certainly had a great deal of respect for the power of religion. He wrote a couple of novels where religion is treated as true. And active in the world, A Stranger in a Strange Land is certainly one of those, and it's certainly his most popular and well-known novel. But before L. Ron Hubbard went off to found his own religion, based on a lot of tips and hints and suggestions from his pals, he was part of a science fiction writing group, very much as I was part of a science fiction writing group in Chicago, a moderately famous one. At least we inherited the name from the people who, you know, went on to write novels, which a couple of us did, but not me. But it was a writing group, and as with such groups, this was a bunch of largely white men of a certain age who were hacking away, trying to make money at less than a penny a word or a penny a word, cranking out science fiction. And they fell together as a support group. They bounced ideas off each other. In a couple of cases, I believe in one famous case, Robert Heinlein helped L. Sprague DeCamp, although I'm not sure if it's DeCamp because I'm doing this just from memory, basically gave him the plots to several stories. He was his friend was blocked, and he gave him, here are some possible stories, you know, that you could write, and that they were very helpful. They helped him sort of break through. So out of that writers group, which included all those people and more, came L. Ron Hubbard, who was just at the time another hack science fiction writer. or pulp science fiction writer who had a roll of butcher block paper mounted above his electric typewriter and would literally just type, take a straight edge, hack off the paper when it got too much to handle, put it in a pile, and just keep writing. And he literally pounded it out hour after hour after hour, and that's how he made money. It wasn't a lot of money, but it was a living. And that was the group that sort of said, hey, you know, if you really want to make money, why don't you found your own religion? And here's an idea. Why don't you use a polygraph? And here's an idea. Why don't you make the aliens, et cetera? So I think I talked about this a little bit last week. Mm-hmm. So that's the timeline. I don't think Robert Heinlein was a very practicing Scientologist, and I don't think anybody in that group ever fell for the religion that L. Ron Hubbard cooked up. That religion was for celebrities.
Sort of cooked up on a dare, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, you know, the as with Mormonism, mm-hmm. its actual roots are guarded by lawyers. Because
okay.
And those
don't sue us.
We don't know. We don't care. We're not members. But the problem with all religions that insert themselves into history mm-hmm. is that they have to explain historical fact.
Right.
If you exist outside of the universe in a completely spiritual plane, you don't have to worry about things like evolution. Mm-hmm. Or chemistry, or why didn't Jesus mention pi in the Bible? You want to prove that you want to prove you're the Son of God? Give me pi to 500 decimals from memory. Boom, I will totally follow you anywhere you want to go. None of that stuff happened. So once you insert a religion into history, once you have L. Ron Hubbard being a real person who existed at a specific place in time with people around him who you can call up and ask, same thing with Mormonism. Mm-hmm. That it existed in a certain place in time, and that makes it susceptible to actual history, which is often very, very unkind to faith.
Well, thank you for that, and thank you for that question. We appreciate all the people that send in questions to us.
Yeah.
The second question of two mm-hmm. is one that I brought up with you last night, uh-huh. Just to kind of get our juices flowing. When you talk about a definition of science fiction as being, if you take the science out, the story falls apart, mm-hmm. what do you mean by the science? I was thinking about Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which I've heard referred to as an early work of science fiction. However, Victor Frankenstein blatantly tells the audience that he won't explain the science
yeah.
of how he animated the monster so that nobody repeats his mistake.
Yes. Well,
does that mean that Frankenstein isn't science fiction, or is the science defined some other way?
No, science is not necessarily science that works.
Mm-hmm.
It is science that potentially could possibly, under some circumstances, work. And the means are always carefully guarded. No one ever tells you how the faster than light drive works or the Heisenberg compensators, which has nothing to do with Heisenberg, the meth dealer, mm-hmm. meth cooker, or any of the other gadgets. In fact, there's a whole bunch of science fiction has a long history. For example, Terminator, mm-hmm. when he's asked to verify his story, the man from the future says, I'm a soldier. I don't know tech stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, then you can't explain any of this. So getting out of explaining how the gadgets actually work is sort of an ancient and noble part of the scam of science fiction writing. Because remember, fiction writing is lying.
Yeah.
All fiction writing is lying. And that's, you know, storytellers are just basically storytellers who are making shit up. The difference between science fiction and fantasy is, I think Asimov said something to the effect that fantasy is stuff that could not ever possibly really happen. There are no dragons.
Yep.
There are no hobbits. And magical spells and incantations, so far as I know and have observed personally, do not work. In science, you can get away with a lot of stuff, but just the slightest sliver of even psychological science you can get away with.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that people could share a consensual hallucination when they're unconscious mm-hmm. and that some creature could get loose in their collective dream and start killing them is the plot of a Philip Dick novel.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And no one knows if that, but it uses the apparatus of science to explain away the plot, the parts of the plot that you just can't explain to get to the actual story you want to tell.
And you know that someday someone is going to invent a semi-solid fuel and they're going to name it dilithium crystals.
Yes.
Just because.
Yes. Why wouldn't they?
Because why wouldn't they? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for those questions. We do appreciate it. If you have any questions for DriftGlass on science fiction, you may send them to me so that we can keep them somewhat of a secret, but I do reserve the right to bring them up as pillow talk whenever I want.
Yeah.
And you can send those to me at mrs.driftglass@gmail.com.
Yeah.
Oh, wait. Yeah. There's one other thing. You wanted to talk about why Babylon 5 and The Newsroom are the same.
I just want to put in the point that I was really disappointed in almost the entire first season of the Newsroom.
And you're bringing this up because Bob and Chez brought it up in their podcast on Wednesday.
I don't do everything Bob and Chez do.
Yeah, you.
Yeah. Bob and Chez jumped off a metaphor. Would you jump off a metaphor too? Yes, I probably would. No, they brought it up because, they were chatting,
cycling
about it.
Through both The Newsroom and Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Which, and I don't know if I would recommend doing that at the same time, because
what
if Tywin Lannister drops sarin gas? That would be really a disaster, wouldn't it?
Well, he sort of does.
He sort of does.
There's chemical warfare in Game of Thrones. That's all I'll say. But the similarity is that the first season of Babylon 5 was kind of bad.
Yeah.
The characters were wooden. They clunked around. The dialogue hadn't really settled down. It got good towards the second half of the first season, as I recall, or the beginning of the second season. But it took many episodes for the woodenness and the clunkiness of the story to get swept out and people to sort of get into their roles and actually start acting. I'm not saying it's the greatest science fiction series ever made. That would be Battlestar Galactica. But it got substantially better once it lost its freshman and sophomore jitters, which appears to be what happened in The Newsroom.
Mm-hmm.
The Newsroom needed a villain. And then Jerry Dantana showed up. And granted, that's really Deus Ex Machina. That's we need the Borg to show up to make this goddamn show interesting. Well, okay, that's fine. Great drama needs great villains or great peril. And he showed up and raised the stakes on it above who is fucking who, pardon my language.
Yeah. No.
And how that was making them all anxious and nervous and shouty, and how it was making them weep and cry and slap and ask, does she like me? Is she into me? I don't know. Why do you ask me? And passing notes around the office like it's high school.
Mm-hmm.
That was the show for the first year. And that was incredibly disappointing for someone like Aaron Sorkin, who has a good reputation and most of it deserve it. So anyway, that's why.
Okay. Let's start the latest episode. Is this episode 195?
I believe it is.
Oh my goodness.
I know. Closing
really
in on 200.
Close to 200.
Remember way back when we said, hey, let's send out a press release for episode 100?
No, and we never did. We never did. We're just going to keep doing this podcast until somebody notices.
Well, we notice, and our listeners.
Our listeners notice, and we appreciate you guys so much. Yeah.
But
yeah, and some of you are somebodies, I think.
Yeah.
If all the plagiarism at certain mainstream blogs is any indication. Okay.
Yeah. Certain people are listening in, and let's just say if we help fill the air with a saturation that eventually other people crystallize into their work, that's highly complimentary.
It is.